Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Jordan Fennell, filling in for Aggie Tupo. Today on the show, Samoa is on alert for measles as cases of the contagious disease spread in New Zealand. Our Samoa reporter Adele Fruin will join the show in just a few minutes to give you an update on how the country is responding. And Australia will soon put in place a social media ban for kids under the age of 16. So what will this mean for Pacific teens at boarding school here?
I'm a bit concerned, like, how am I going to communicate with my friends back home, because I don't have, like, I only have, like, their socials, like, I don't have their numbers or anything like that.
Also, Timor-Leste has officially become a member of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and President José Ramos Horta says the accession is a step towards economic opportunity for his poor country.
With a market of 700 million people, in which Timor is part of now, more opportunity to attract investors.
Those stories and more here on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, we head to Tonga, where campaign season is underway, with more than 70 candidates running for a seat in Parliament at next month's election. Reporter Finau Fanua spoke to the people about the issues they think candidates should be focused on.
On November 20th, tens of thousands of Tongans are expected to cast the votes to determine the kingdom's next prime minister. The election comes less than a year since former Prime Minister Siyasi Sovaleni Hukavumeliku resigned before a vote of no confidence against him. But what are the key election issues that Tongans will be considering when choosing their local representative? In Tonga Tapu, it varies from the economy, crime, political instability, to even just basic infrastructure.
The biggest challenge that I'm seeing in my neighbourhood are the poor state of the roads. They're damaged and full of potholes. It's difficult for people to drive and walk on. When it rains, the roads become flooded.
First of all is the roads. The roads, and not only that, but also the matangas, you know, the tourist attractions. Like, if you've ever been to Vava'u, like, you go to the tourist attractions there, it's beautiful. Like, they look after it, you know, they make sure people want to come there. But, like, here in Tonga, you go to the tourist attractions, most of it, it's not looked after.
I think the taxes are too high. It's become more and more costly to go shopping.
The government needs to be united, and Parliament should stop filing petitions for a vote of no confidence. These petitions are just a nuisance. I really think Sovaleni should have been allowed to finish his term. Whoever becomes Prime Minister should be allowed to finish their term.
A lot of youth or a lot of kids are using drugs. So yeah, I feel like the government has not worked on anything like for youth.
Just over 66,000 Tongans are eligible to vote in the election. The last saw a high turnout. But can that continue for this election? Well, I came across a number of young people who said they had no intention of participating.
Actually, I have no idea what was going on in the government and stuff.
For me personally, there's so many people that's been voted inside, and all they do is eat money and lie to us before the voting, and then when we voted for them, they go inside and do something else totally different from what they promised to do. And I'm just like, it's a waste of time.
I haven't thought about voting, to be honest. I don't know anything about politics.
I actually have no idea what the candidates are and who they are.
Yes.
That was a Tongan noble, the Duiha Deho, reading out a message from the Tongan king to parliament last Thursday. It's an annual ritual that marks the closure of parliament. In his speech, the king stressed the economy as a key election issue. It comes only weeks after a law was passed giving the king the exclusive right to appoint the foreign ministerial portfolio for Tonga's cabinet, a move which has been deeply criticized as autocratic.
Economically, there is much to do in the near future, so vote wisely in this coming election.
Former Prime Minister Siyasi Sovelenihua Kavamiliku is widely projected to win his constituency. In fact, he only has one candidate running against him. His popularity stems from his leadership during Tonga's traumatic Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcanic eruption, as well as the COVID pandemic. However, the current Prime Minister, Aisake Eke, is also projected by many to win his constituency. I visited Eke's home village of Vatu'u, where he commands a strong following. It's a common feature of Tongan elections for candidates to command the support of villages where they come from.
He's helped our village a lot. For example, the roads have been developed and there's a lot of community work. We don't see any drug dealers in this village. I feel safe here, thanks to him.
But it won't be the public that chooses the Prime Minister. It'll be the candidates who win their constituencies. 9 of Tonga's 26 parliamentarians are noble representatives who are elected by less than 33 chiefs. And these noble representatives are expected to be hostile to Huakavamiliku. It's a fact that makes it unlikely for Huakavamiliku to become Prime Minister again, unless the election sees a large influx of new faces sympathetic to him. Regardless of the election results, Tonga's new government will be under pressure to impress a public undistracted by the COVID pandemic and disaster recovery, and to ease many unsettled by an ongoing friction between the monarchy, the nobles, and the people's representatives.
Out of Tonga, that was Finau Funua with that report. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Now, 6 years after a deadly outbreak of measles, Samoa is again on alert for the contagious disease. Increasing numbers of measles cases are being reported in New Zealand, which is Samoa's biggest source of visitors. And local health authorities are warning that vaccination rates are low in some parts of the country, and they're urging parents to get their children immunised. And joining me now for more details on this is our Samoa reporter, Adele Fruin. Talofa, Adele.
Talofa Lala Jordan.
Lovely to have you on the show. Now, Adele, tell me, what prompted Samoa's health ministry to issue this latest measles alert?
Yes. Firstly, the increase in measles cases in New Zealand has caused a concern for, you know, members of the public, especially considering that the Samoa's health ministry, of course, they identified areas in Samoa with low vaccination rates. Now, that's just not also the concern. The concern here is that, you know, we've got our people traveling back and forth, and, you know, now that borders have opened, you know, there's this free travel around, you know, and most of our people that come to visit us in Samoa are from New Zealand. So, there's, you know, and everybody just does not want to, you know, have history repeat itself, basically.
Yeah, of course, back in 2019, there was that deadly outbreak of measles in Samoa with many, many young children dying. So what is word on the street? What are people talking about on the ground there? What are they saying to each other about this, about their concerns?
Yes, so, you know, the moment the measles alert was issued, you know, and I've also spoken to, you know, parents in local churches as well, including mine. You know, they've shared, you know, they fear for their children, of course. There's great fear that, you know, we will get to see, you know, what happened in 2019 happen again, all because they know that some parts of the country have low immunization rates. Now, at the moment, you know, and not just that, you know, during recently Samoa has experienced, you know, a dengue fever outbreak. And even when that happened, you know, a lot of our schools shut down for so many weeks. And, you know, and but with the measles, it spreads easily as well. So it has caused, yeah, I would say a lot of some parents are panicking and just now pushing for all the children to be vaccinated, especially. And even on social media, parents are sharing, you know, the measles alert and urging those parents that haven't vaccinated their children to please take this, you know, measles alert seriously. You know, now is not the time to, you know, leave your children until it's last minute, you know, to get assistance. So, yes, that's what's happening on the ground at the moment.
And like you say that you've got parents who are trying to spread that word about vaccinations. What about what the government is doing? What steps are the health ministry taking to improve vaccination rates, especially in low coverage areas?
Yes. So the health ministry or Samoa's health ministry is not only urging parents to get vaccinated through various, I would say, public awareness through the through social media, through television programs. But, you know, they've extended opening hours for some of the clinics just so to assist with, you know, with the demand of, you know, children needing to be vaccinated. But that's just not it as well. They've also have a service where, you know, nurses, doctors can go, you know, to the homes of, you know, especially for our, you know, for our families that live far away from, you know, local hospitals. You know, they have this service open for them to cater to that need in case they have problems transport or traveling. You know, now mind you, also have to take into consideration that in some of these families, there could be so many children. And if you take one child, you've got to take all of them. Now, you know, it becomes harder because you're not supposed to, because there are certain guidelines also that you cannot bring all your children at a hospital, for example. And it's just, this is just to ensure they don't get, you know, infected with any sort of disease that's been, you know, that's being treated at the hospital. So, yes, these are just some of the factors that are being considered through the government's response to this.
All right, so like a number of steps being taken there, like you say there, with home visits as well. How does this compare to the situation that happened back in 2019 when there was that very deadly outbreak? We had obviously a very different government in power at that time and a bit of a different response. What lessons have been learned and what is that difference between the two responses these years apart?
Now, for the 2019 measles outbreak, you know, there were so many factors, you know, to consider. Firstly, around this time, there was a fear among parents to get their children vaccinated, all because there was a human error that led to the deaths of some children from the Big Island of Savai. You know, this was when they administered, you know, the measles vaccine, but it was a human error that caused the death for some of these, you know, infants. And that spread panic around the whole country. Now, that was a major factor into why most parents did not want, refused to get their children vaccinated. And it was also evident through the parents who lost, you know, children, who lost loved ones to measles. And they too admitted themselves that they just would not want to take the risk of having their, you know, children be vaccinated. But, you know, and also around that time, that just wasn't the, you know, another factor. Another factor around that time is that during the time that the government had to investigate that human error, you know, it led to them actually closing down and prohibiting the administration of this vaccine, a measles vaccine. So it led to so many children not being vaccinated for quite some time. And then plus the fear of parents getting them, you know, by the time they were trying to push for vaccination again, it was just too late. The vaccination rates was too low to even consider. Now, compare that to, you know, to this year now, now that parents have learned so much. And also another factor was that you know, back then parents would choose to take their children to see traditional healers compared to choosing to go to the hospital. But, you know, lessons learned, everybody is pushing for the vaccination now. Parents, you know, even those who lost loved ones to measles, they too are pushing for, you know, for all parents to take their children to be vaccinated. And also the lessons learned about not prioritizing, you know, treatment from traditional healers and just focusing on our local doctors and nurses.
So, yeah, quite an evolution in response over the last 6 years. My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. And I have our Samoa reporter, Adele Fruin, on the line with me, updating about the new cases of measles in New Zealand and the concern in Samoa at the moment. But Adele, I want to switch just now to a different topic, completely unrelated, actually, to measles. We've seen an interesting photo of Samoa's Prime Minister pop up online that's circulating with allegations that the photo has been altered. Can you tell me a little bit more about this photo? Who's behind it and what do we know?
Okay, so the photo in question is Samoa's Prime Minister, Laulian Malintoa Pulatevau, forces, you know, photo during a meeting with New Zealand's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Valvasamania Winston Peters. You know, as you may know, our Prime Minister's not in the country. He's in New Zealand for medical treatment and won't be back for a while. Now, what had happened was there was a meeting and, you know, photos were taken. And, of course, the meeting was a bilateral meeting focusing on priorities such as the Manawanui sinking and, you know, among other issues. But, you know, the confusion was that what local media is also, including the Samoa Observer, recently issued a report that the photo taken was altered. So while there were three photos, originally there were three photos that was issued by the government of Samoa. One of the photos, however, showcased the Prime Minister sitting on a chair, while the other two photos indicated he's sitting on a wheelchair. So the altered photo of him sitting on a wheelchair caused a lot of confusion and also, you know, people questioning, you know, who actually is behind me. And so far, the government of Samoa has not issued a statement to confirm who exactly was it, whether it was them or was it somebody else that, you know, altered the photo of the Prime Minister. At the moment also, you know, we cannot confirm who exactly is behind this at the moment. That is still, you know, there's still been a request to the government of Samoa to see who exactly is behind this. You know, while, you know, members of the public have also responded to this altered photo, some have even questioned what was necessary, what was the actual, you know, motive or reason behind the altered photo, and questioning, you know, also, you know, why? Is there something that, you know, that the person that altered the photo is scared of sharing? You know, and also members of the public also already know our Prime Minister's situation medically also. So it's causing a lot of confusion among members of the public over, you know, this photo. But so far, no word from government.
Very interesting. Well, no doubt you'll keep us up to date if we do get any answers from Samoa's government. Adele Fruin, thank you for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Jordan. Have a lovely day.
That was our Samoa reporter Adele Fruin speaking there.
Talo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific. Culture Compass, Tuesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat on this Tuesday morning. And still to come on the show, Timor-Leste has become the 11th member of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, fulfilling the vision of President José Ramos Horta. And you'll hear from him coming up shortly.
With a market of 700 million people, in which Timor is part of now, more opportunity to attract investors.
That's right, a lot of economic opportunity from President José Ramos Horta's perspective there.
Pacific Beat.
There have been celebrations in Timor-Leste after it was officially made a member of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, also known as ASEAN. More than a decade after it first applied, Timor-Leste has become the 11th member in what is the association's first expansion since the 1990s. It fulfills a vision set out by President José Ramos Horta nearly half a century ago. And the ABC's global affairs editor, Laura Tingle, sat down with the president in Kuala Lumpur, and he says the accession is a step towards economic opportunity for his poor country.
This is a region with almost 700 million people, with several trillion dollars as a joint GDP, very dynamic economies, plenty of trade between those countries, and our trade is primarily with Indonesia and China. So, talking about regional economic integration, we literally fully integrated in the region. Energy sector, it has been 100% with Australia. Merchandise, import, export with Indonesia, China, and the rest of other countries. And this tend to increase, but with a market of 700 million people, in which Timor is part of now, more opportunity to attract investors to Timor-Leste, because we still have a very low labor cost. Our tax regime is among the lowest in the world, definitely lowest in Asia. So it is very attractive. And then, of course, there are other motivations, because we are peaceful. We don't have organized crime, we don't have political violence, we don't have armed robbery in the streets, in banks, shops, homes of people. So every condition is there. So that's why Japanese, South Korean, Chinese, Indonesians, plenty are exploring now to invest in Timor-Leste.
So what are there particular sectors of the economy that membership of ASEAN will allow you to diversify into? Have you got some particular areas that you think ASEAN can help develop?
ASEAN countries can help, are helping in many ways. First, that has been happening for years, is on the development of our pool of human resources. Hundreds of Timorese graduated from university throughout Southeast Asia, obtaining master's degrees and doctorate from reputed universities. In other areas is precisely private direct investment firms. But not enough to respond to our own policy strategy in diversifying from oil and gas revenues, in diversifying into, let's say, tourism. We need the completion of the airport. We need more hotels, not in Delhi, but outside Delhi. And then we can, because we have every condition to have Timor-Leste a next major tourist destination. We have the best, the richest biodiversity in the world. And besides, it's protected. No bleaching, no overfishing. The waters are crystal clear. So we are going to be a major tourist destination, I would say, in only 2-3 years' time.
That was Timor-Leste's President Jose Ramos Horta speaking there to Laura Tingle.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
That's right, you're with me, Jordan Fennell, here on Pacific Beat. Coming up on the show, when the Women's Rugby League World Cup kicks off in 2026, there will be three Pacific Island nations involved for the very first time. In just a few minutes, you'll hear about the successful World Cup qualification mission for the Bulikula. And Lonely Planet have named Solomon Islands as one of the top 25 countries to visit in 2026. So in about 15 minutes, I'll be joined by James Talotuita from Tourism Solomons to find out how the country's tourism sector is preparing. First, though, Australia's social media ban is just around the corner. And for many kids and teens from the Pacific who attend boarding school in Australia, it's an unwelcome change. The Australian government has legislated that from December 10, people under the age of 16 will not be able to sign up for social media accounts, and to do so will be against the law. The federal government says the ban is needed to protect the mental health and well-being of children and teens. Lucy Cooper reports from Townsville.
It's lunchtime at Townsville Grammar School in North Queensland, and I'm talking with 15-year-old EJ about the Australian government's social media ban for those under 16.
Oh, I just know it's going to be annoying.
He's from Central Province in PNG, but currently lives in Hong Kong and attends boarding school in Australia.
Because you can't really communicate with friends overseas, you know. It's harder to do it as a boarder. Can't really escape the living of being in boarding. Can't go for a quick scroll, just to chill around. It's all gone.
He's worried about the ban because he uses Snapchat to talk with his sisters.
Loss of just overall interaction with other people. And it's harder to communicate with your friends back as a boarder and being so far apart from them. It's a lot. It's a lot of things to go through.
He understands that the government wants to keep kids safe, but wishes it was restrictions rather than a full ban. He and his mates are already talking about ways to get around it.
VPNs, using each other's ID, maybe just like someone older, age of 16, has like an older brother or sister, maybe some of those, and use theirs and they use their sisters or brothers.
For 14-year-old Cleo from East New Britain in PNG, she doesn't think the ban is a good idea.
I feel like because that's just how we all like interact with each other nowadays. Like we wouldn't like, we don't have each other's numbers. Like we normally just like snap each other and like it's just how we interact with each other nowadays, I guess.
She uses WhatsApp to keep in touch with her parents and Snapchat to message her friends back home.
I'm a bit concerned like how am I going to communicate with my friends back home because I don't have like, I only have like their socials, like I don't have their numbers or anything like that.
A world first ban, social media platforms will be expected to detect and deactivate or remove accounts from existing underage users, but they don't need to verify the age of every user. Dr. Amanda Watson is a communications researcher at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University.
It responds to concerns about a range of issues to do with children's social media access and potential negative impacts, such as negative impacts on mental health through, for instance, bullying amongst children, possible issues to do with child sexual abuse and grooming of children and so on. So there's a range of reasons why the Australian government is introducing it, and there are certainly very mixed views in the Australian community amongst parents and young people and everyday people and experts as to whether it's a good idea or not.
She says Fiji is the main country in the Pacific that will be monitoring the rollout of Australia's ban closely.
They've set up the Online Safety Commission, which is a bit similar to Australia's E-Safety Commission, and indeed I believe that Australia's E-Safety Commission has offered some support to the Fijian Online Safety Commission. And so certainly in Fiji, I think they're looking closely at these kinds of things. And other countries in different ways are looking at online safety, cybersecurity and other issues to the best of their ability as well.
But the impact on Pacific Islanders living in Australia may have been overlooked.
I think most of us have tended to think about the implications of the social media ban for young users in Australia as being with respect to young people, children in Australia. But of course, there are people visiting, and as you say, people visiting for schooling, so they might be here for quite long periods of time. And I guess people coming for shorter periods of time too, possibly with their families or for medical treatment or a range of reasons.
Back in Townsville, and 15-year-old Tafaru from PNG uses TikTok and Snapchat to stay in touch with loved ones. She'll be unable to use either in the coming weeks.
I feel like it's good to an extent because some kids like really rely on social media.
In what ways?
Well, they use it for like to regulate their emotions and just, yeah, when they're bored.
But she welcomes the ban.
I'm pretty sure my mom knows a little bit about it, but they don't know everything, like how it's working.
Dr. Amanda Watson says there is uncertainty about what exactly the ban means for borders from the Pacific and those living in Australia temporarily.
I'm not quite sure how the Australian government is going to handle people who are here temporarily and how they're going to manage, does that mean that the social media companies need to block access for those young people when they're resident within the Australian jurisdiction? I'm not sure. If it does mean that the Pacific Islander young people who are under the relevant age, who are residing in boarding schools in Australia or in Australia for medical treatment or for other reasons, then it would potentially have an impact on their ability to maintain social contact with family and loved ones in their Pacific home country. So certainly that's something that maybe hasn't been given much thought to as this legislation has been developed.
Dr. Amanda Watson, a communication researcher at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University.
Join Sosse Fomoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, when the Women's Rugby League World Cup kicks off in 2026, there will be three Pacific Island nations involved for the first time. Co-hosts Papua New Guinea and Samoa were already in the mix, but now, as Richard Hewitt reports, a third team has joined them just 6 years after they played their first international match of any description.
While the Pacific Rugby League Championships have been unfolding closer to home, Fiji's Bulikula have been over in Canada looking to secure the last available slot at the Women's Rugby League World Cup next year, and they have done it in emphatic fashion at the IRL World Series. After defeating the host nation 48-0 in the semi-finals, the Fijians have gone on to crush Nigeria in the final and guarantee themselves a World Cup place for the first time in the country's history.
Fifth and last tackle coming up.
Knocking on that door again.
Deciding to just pierce through the middle. It's number 14, Ebony Lang.
Beautiful work. Oh, does she have it again? Just short.
Great cover tackle by the fullback there.
Oh, and through the middle she goes.
Getting over the line, I believe that is number 8 for Fiji, Lalani Asham.
Another one for her today.
Fiji, your winners over Nigeria, 62-4, and will be going to the Rugby League World Cup in 2026.
You can just see how much it means to them. Look at these girls on the field right now. They should be so proud of how hard they work to come here.
Let's make some noise for your qualifier for next year's World Cup, Fiji.
Just to repeat that final score, 62-4 to Fiji, with Cass Staples scoring 4 tries and Leilani Asham from the Newcastle Knights finishing with 3. And here's the chairman of the Fiji NRL, Aquila Massey.
Today is a really important day and the proudest day of the Fiji Bulikula team as we make it to the World Cup. I want to say thank you very much to the players. You have done us great things. You've made us proud, not only of rugby league, but as a nation, Fiji, to secure the support.
Quite an achievement for Fiji, where the women's program only began in 2019 and was halted for some time during the COVID pandemic. Now that the Bulikula will line up alongside two other Pacific Island nations, Samoa and Papua New Guinea, at the World Cup to be hosted by Australia and PNG next year.
That was Richard Hewitt reporting on a successful World Cup qualification mission for the Bulikula, and it will be interesting to see how they fare in their debut tournament next year.
Join me, Melissa Macon, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
My name is Jordan Fennell. You're with me here on Pacific Beat. Now, last week, three Vanuatu students received scholarships from the Serbian government to study in the country. They were awarded scholarships under the World in Serbia program, further strengthening educational and diplomatic ties between Vanuatu and the Republic of Serbia. The number of scholarships awarded to Vanuatu students is expected to grow in the coming years, reflecting Serbia's commitment to supporting educational development in Vanuatu. And Finau Fonua spoke to the Serbian ambassador to the Pacific Islands, Mr. Raed Stefanovic.
For the last 5, 6, 7 years, Serbia has been offering the scholarship to the Pacific Island countries to study abroad for the young people with a free-to-choose area of the study. Everything is covered, free education for like first-degree level studies, undergraduate, PhD, master's or PhD studies, vocational studies. So there is a variety, actually, and it's totally open for the candidate to choose the field of study. Of course, Serbia is not a huge and big country, you know, but he has a very good experience with this kind of program, and African countries, our experience showed that actually it's one of the best way to build the people-to-people link, in a way, because, you know, when those young people spend a few years learning and studying in Serbia, they are like introduced and get to know the culture, the language, they have opportunity to present their own countries.
To get this scholarship, are they required to learn Serbian or is it in English?
There are some curriculums which are available in English, like, for example, medical studies. You can have it fully in English. But, of course, having in mind that there's a majority of the program is in Serbian language, that's why my government is offering free one-year course of Serbian language. We think it's important, you know, when the foreign students are coming to any foreign country to learn some of the local language, you know, to be much comfortable, you know, in that area, although the English is widely spoken in Serbia. And of course, you know, we would be glad for some of those students to bring some of the Serbian language back home.
Does it bring a lot of pride to see your language being spread across the world like this?
Oh, of course, you know, I think who wouldn't be, you know, like proud of this. You know, I had the opportunity actually to meet all and each of every one of those students actually currently in Belgrade. I had opportunity to talk with them, for example, when the last year the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs of Vanuatu had a bilateral visit to Serbia. And of course, we organized a get together with the students, and I was in the position, you know, to talk with those young people, and they are like really remarkable, and the knowledge of Serbian is really, really great, and it was very, you know, I was proud to hear them, you know, like speaking in my language, you know, and of course to share some of the positive experience they had during during their studies in Belgrade. As I mentioned, it's a worldwide program, so we have young people from all around the world, practically from the Central and Latin America through Africa, Asia, and of course the Pacific. And it's also opportunity for those young people to link and to get connected with the international cohort currently living in Belgrade.
That was our reporter, Finau Fonua, speaking with the Canberra-based Serbian ambassador to the Pacific Islands, Mr. Raed Stefanovic.
Jacob Quiet, we have a winner.
Yes, we do, Michael Chow. The 2025 Pacific Break title goes to Mantis from Vanuatu with his track, Weatherman.
Yeah, don't try to play with the weatherman. I make it rain fire, call the fireman. All boy come around like a brother man. Me one, me no not a one.
Yes, yeah. We called Mantis to break the news, and here's how it went down.
Bro, we just wanted to say a huge congratulations, Mantis, because you are the winner of Pacific Break 2025.
Woo! Let's go! Weatherman!
Yes! You're not joking with me, right?
You know, no,
this is for real.
No, yeah, man.
Keep it 100. Me no play, me no yeah, man.
Huge congratulations to Mantis. You're off to Womb Adelaide, my friend.
Mm-hmm. And thank you to everyone who entered this year's Pacific Break competition from right across the Pacific. And we look forward to next year. Mantis.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat this morning. Time to take a look back at our main stories today. 6 years after a deadly outbreak of measles, Samoa is again on alert for the contagious disease. Local health authorities are warning vaccination rates are low in some parts of the country, and they're urging parents to get their children immunized. And I spoke this morning with our reporter, Adele Fruin.
The increase in measles cases in New Zealand has caused a concern for, you know, members of the public, especially considering that the Samoa's health ministry, of course, they identified areas in Samoa with low vaccination rates.
And Pacific teens at boarding schools here in Australia are concerned about a social media ban that is about to come into effect. The Australian government has legislated that from December 10th, people under the age of 16 will not be able to sign up for social media accounts, and to do so will be against the law.
I'm a bit concerned, like, how am I going to communicate with my friends back home, because I don't have, like, I only have, like, their socials, like, I don't have their numbers or anything like that.
You can catch those stories online. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. at PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. at PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nisha Daly.